You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Hi, everyone. Well, look, an exciting show today. I have Dr. Paul Moon with me. He is a professor of history at AUT, obviously here in Auckland. He's a prolific writer, commentator, and, of course, historian. So welcome, Paul.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing really, really, really well. Hey, it's nice to reconnect with you. And first question I've got to ask you, I've told you Dr. Paul Moon, but you are a professor. So have I completely mistitled you?
No, not at all. And I'd prefer just Paul. I'm not not very big into titles at all. So Paul's much easier.
Oh, well, we'll keep running with Paul. So, listeners, this morning we've got quite a lot to talk about. One of it is obviously the books that Paul is writing. Very, very, prolific writer. But also, I would say, one of our eminent and well-outspoken historians. So we want to talk a little bit about history. What's history about? Why is it important? But I said at the start, Paul, you're prolific. You're prolific with your writing. You've very kindly given me over recent times a copy of your Auckland, the 20th century story, Colonizing New Zealand. Fantastic books, great reads. And most recently, you've just released a biography of Arne Westra. So first and foremost, how do you find the time to write all these books?
Well, there's probably, I don't know, probably two ways of answering that. One of them is that I do work long hours. The extreme case was with the Arne Westra biography, where there were some days I was getting close to 20 hours a day on it. So that's a long day, and you get 4 hours sleep and then you're back into it. And it requires a lot of physical preparation, believe it or not, to do that sort of thing. But the other thing is very early on, and I got this from music, I realized that there are certain composers who never produced drafts of their music. Everything they wrote was in the final form. And I thought, that's interesting. And I remember trying to write a book like that, and it took a very long time because every sentence had to be crafted as though it was the final version. But over time, you get more practiced at it. So now I'll write a book, and apart from a few commas or spelling mistakes, what I draft is the final version. And it saves having to go through umpteen different drafts, which consumes months and months. So that's part of it as well.
That's fantastic. And I better be clear, my next comment's not putting me anywhere on the level that you do or work. But I recall in my early university days, when I had brown hair, long time ago, would actually handwrite my essays, you know, 3,000 or 5,000 words, and then I would type them up. And it took me about a year, as stupid as I am, to go, why don't I just type them first? Why am I doubling up my work? So I've learned another further element from your good self here. So, as I say, you've written many, many books, but your latest is on Arne. And I probably pronounced that wrong, and apologies to her and, of course, to you. But she's a remarkable New Zealander and also originally from the Netherlands, or some will know as Hollands. Tell us about her, her life, why you wrote the book.
I was reasonably familiar with her photographs. I think a lot of people have seen them and not know even who took them. She's been photographing in New Zealand, or she was, from the late 1950s, really up until her death last year. So a very prolific photographer, over 300,000 photographs. And this is in the days when you have a film and a camera. So that's a lot of work. And she really documented almost every aspect of New Zealand society over that period. If you want to know what's happening at a farm stock sale, school playground, sex workers, just about anything you can imagine, she took photographs of it, and of a standard that one expert who's an academic in this field, worked for 20 years lecturing photography, has said he puts from the top five social documentary photographers in the post-war era anywhere in the world. That's how good she was. She won a number of international awards, but not really recognized here. apart from the very controversial Wash Day at the Par, which is a primary school journal that was published in 1964, which depicted a Maori family in relative poverty, but a very loving, happy, caring, nurturing family. There were protests about that back in 1964, that it depicted Maori in a state of poverty, and the Maori Women's Welfare League said this is unacceptable. The campaign against that journal reached the point, and it came to an extraordinary point, where the Department of Education, as it then was, said, we're going to recall all 38,000 copies of that journal and pulp them. So they did. They instructed all the primary schools in New Zealand to send that school journal back to Wellington, and it was trucked off to a site where it was destroyed. Now, a few copies survived, quite a few copies, probably 100 or 200, but the majority of that 38,000 were destroyed. And this was very early on in her career. She's still in her late 20s. And that was a devastating blow, but she persisted with photography and produced really some of the most remarkable photographs we've got of our country. And I've described it in the book as like a national photo album.
Oh, I found it quite remarkable. I was not aware that I was familiar with her work. A little bit of what you said earlier, there are these photos, these images, which we see as part of our history, but I had never, and it's a shame on me, thought about who was behind them. And it was only when you published your book and started talking about it that I realised who it was. She was quite, well, maybe this is more reflection on me, Paul, that I didn't take the time to know, but she strikes me rather as a bit of an enigma, or someone who didn't seek the limelight. Would that be a fair comment?
To start off with, she had her challenges, and they're laid out in the book. A very abusive upbringing, and some mental health challenges along the way that got quite serious at one stage. I, when you research someone, you go into all sorts of odd avenues. One of them is I looked at her finances at one stage and found out that for 1 year, her earnings were half the minimum pay for that year. So she really struggled financially for a lot of her career. Most people give up that type of career that she had in about 18 months. She did it for over six decades. So very, very committed. And she had a particular eye for capturing moments that very few photographers had. The consequence is these are works of supreme quality in terms of documentary photography, but they're also supreme works of art photography. And that's very rare to do that for a short period, but for six decades, it's almost unheard of internationally.
So would you say she was clearly someone driven by passion, or was it also a vocation? As you say, she was making very little money, as a lot of artists find, but she persevered. So what drove her, do you think? Was it just the love of the art, the people, or a sense of mission?
I think there are probably a couple of things, and I don't know the full answer. I don't think anyone does, and I suspect perhaps not even she would be aware of it. I don't know. But certainly when you're that good at something, there is a compulsion to work at it. Interestingly, she never got into a rut. She never repeated the same technique, as good as it was, over and over again. She was always exploring new ways of doing things. I think also, to a degree, when you're so focused on a particular undertaking, especially if it's a creative undertaking, your mind shunts to the periphery some of the day-to-day challenges you face because you're just focused on that. If you have and I'm not a psychologist or anything, but if you do have a problem that's bearing down on you, one way of dealing with that is to push it to the edge, to keep it out of sight while you're working on this. And I think that can form a pattern. And she almost conceded something to that effect in the early 90s in some notes she wrote to herself, that photography was a way of grappling with issues.
Obviously, I didn't know her, but in my own life and background, dealt with a lot of people in different situations. And one of the things I've noticed, some of the people with the darkest demons are often the most creative, outgoing, and generous. It's sort of the flip side of coins. So if you have someone like myself who's relatively boringly in life, boringly creative, but actually some people are said, yeah, it's the light and dark, yin and yang, all of that. But it sounds like she had her struggles and yet such a life a life-giving creativity that she was able to generate and share with us.
Very much so. Yes, and that's the other thing. She absolutely wasn't driven by profit. And you might think, well, that's a naive approach, but it's also a liberating approach, because then she could focus on what was important. The images she took are ones that she cared about, not that she was being paid to do. And so you get that sense of care and deep interest in those images, and that just radiates out of them. And you look at them, and it's very hard to look at an Answestra photograph and just briefly give it a glance and move on. They're absorbing, and the more you look at them, the more you get absorbed by them.
Well, one that's in your book or you've shared on social media is a young Māori boy. And I'm going to struggle with this because we're on radio. There's no visuals, so I'll see if I can describe it and certainly correct me. But he's leaning up against a window and she's photographed him. But part of his body is manifest, if you will, through the window. But it's perfectly formed. It's not distorted. Yet at the same time, we're actually seeing him through a medium, through the glass, and I've just been intrigued by it. It just keeps drawing me in.
It does. The context of that is, this is the period of urban migration where vast number of Māori started to move from rural areas into the towns and cities, particularly Auckland and Wellington. So here's this young teenager, and of course the temptation of the cities was all the glamour, or part of it anyway, the bright lights, the entertainment, and so on. And this is a dreary, rainy day, and he's in this street, and it's grim. His face reflects that. He's got a sort of a pondering look on his face, and there's no sense of glamour whatsoever. And then she, as you say, she plays with this idea of looking through glass windows, looking at reflections, and there's attention in so many of her photographs, and this is one of them, that it's almost like a puzzle you're trying to resolve, and you never get to the point of resolution. There's always something slightly off balance or slightly tense that you can't sort out. And that's the mark of a person who's really at the top of their game when it comes to that sort of photography.
Well, you've encapsulated for me for a lot of the dynamic. It just keeps drawing me in. Even as I was preparing for this interview, I kept going back and looking at it. And each time, for me, saw and then found something new. And I suppose that, as you say, speaks to the quality of her work. She's obviously and sadly passed on. But if I can ask, how did you get involved with her? What drew you to this story? As I say, you've written about Auckland. You've written about the Edwardian. You've spoken about colonisation. What drew you to her story?
Well, I was familiar with the Wash Day at the Pass story since the 80s. I was interested in her photographs, and the more I looked at them, the more I became interested in them. And I went to get her biography to find out who was behind all these photographs. There wasn't a biography, and I realised at this point she was in her early 80s, and I thought, not only when you're at that age have you not got many years left, but probably the people who were part of your career, your friends and colleagues early on, we're talking about the 60s and 70s here, they're probably of the same age. And I thought, if there's going to be a record of her life, it has to be done pretty promptly. So, and I've never done this before, and I've never done it since. I just emailed her, a complete stranger, and said, my name is Paul Moon, effectively I'm a historian, I'd like to write your biography. And she never replied. But what happened in the meantime, after months, there was no reply, and I thought, well, this isn't going to happen. And that was okay, so I just parked it there. But she had spent all that time contacting numerous people trying to find out about me, to find out, could I do a good job, was I reliable, all that sort of thing. And then her agent got in touch with me after many months, and we met, and that turned out to be sort of another stage in the interview process almost. Then I met her, and then we chatted and so on, and she consented for the book to be written, and sadly shortly afterwards she died. But there was a lot of information that we were able to get, months and months of interview transcript, all her private papers, all her correspondence, and that was really the backbone of the book, and that's how it came about.
remarkable in itself, but says me again, what a hint of her own personality that she's taken the time to research who you were, wanted to be careful, I suppose, also like constructing a shot. Take your time, work it out, don't just fire away. So just before we move on to a wider discussion of history in and of itself, as a historian, is there something in these images, images in themselves, not particularly her photographs, is there something deeper in imagery when it comes to history? You know, the whole picture says 1,000 words, and it's not to try and put up a false interplay between the written and the visual, but as a historian, do you see something quite profound in photography in particular?
Definitely, and that's a very good point, because, you know, I've made this point to some people recently that every couple of years there's some academic or some journalist in New Zealand who publishes a book or a paper on New Zealand identity, and they all fail. I gave the analogy, it's rather like clutching at fog. You can see it all around you, but if you try to grab a piece of fog to analyze it, you end up with nothing. It's elusive. And that's the nature of identity. It's a very complex concept. It may not even exist. The New Zealand identity might just be the composite of 5 million individual identities. But the idea of this, you know, so you can look through recent, the last 4 or 5 decades, things like the Quarter Acre section, that's quintessential New Zealand, or rugby, racing, beer. And then we move on to the southern man, the stoic, silent type, and on and on and on we go. None of them work. They're all stereotypes, they're all cliched, and they date very quickly. But if you want to describe what New Zealand is like, what the essence of being in New Zealand is like from 1960 to the present time, the single best way of doing that is looking at that collection of Hans Westra's photographs, because they cover everything. And you know when you look at these, I mean, there's a great photograph I saw recently of hers. She took it in a Lower Hutt primary school late one afternoon. It's empty, and she just took a photograph of the playground. And every person who grew up, say, in the 1970s in New Zealand or 60s, who went to a primary school, state school, and had a playground like that, we all did, it just resonates so much. That's the essence of that New Zealand experience at school. And then she's got them in other places as well. Shopping, for example, a marae, you name it. And so the cumulative effect of looking at these, you build up a sense, yes, this is the New Zealand identity. No writer will ever be able to do what she did. And she inadvertently created that sense of the country.
Again, I've used the word a few times, but it is quite profound. And I'm pleased to hear you say it, and I'm biased on this. It's because it's been one of my perspectives. I get quite frustrated in general when, be it politicians or others, have tried to find this, as you say, national identity. For me, it's always been akin to a teenager sitting in the mirror asking, who am I? It doesn't go particularly anywhere. And I like your fog analogy as well. But there is something, again, profound, deep, that draws us in through photography. Would you mind if I ask, do you think it's the same with video? Does video footage have the same depth? Or is there something about the tricky black and white 2D image which doesn't speak beyond colour? So you can see I'm not an artist, but it asks you to engage.
Yes, it does. Video footage is evocative as well. If you see, if you have your 21st birthday, say, videoed, and then 20 years later you look at it, of course it's going to bring back memories. It has a nostalgic component to it. But with, as you say, with black and white photography, particularly when it's done of the quality that Hans Westra did, it forces you to wrestle with it. It's not an easy task. You don't just look at it and go, oh, yes, tick, I remember that. You have to start engaging with that photograph. And in the course of engaging with it, the sense of relationship to the past deepens and it broadens. And the more you look at her photographs, the more it does that. Of course, the risk is that it becomes almost like a prosthetic memory. It's something you haven't experienced personally, but you align it with what your sense of the past is about. And it's very powerful from that perspective.
Well, I'm just grateful you've taken the time to share her story, not only through photography, of course. I suppose a bit of a paradox. There's lots of words as well, but that's apt and appropriate for an historian. Before we switch to the wider discussion of history, tell our listeners how they can get hold of your book.
It's in bookshops and I imagine it's available online as well. So if you search on the internet, it'll pop up somewhere.
Certainly encourage people to do so. So the little bit that I've seen of it so far is well worth engaging with. So again, Paul, thank you for sharing her story with us. Obviously her photography, but also an element of New Zealand. That's really appreciated. So thinking then about the wider question of history, say you're a professor of history, it's something you've written prolifically around. I suppose the question is that some people raise with me, and as a student of philosophy myself, why is history important? Why should we bother to be looking at the past when life's so busy here in the present?
And that's one of the most common questions I get. Why bother studying something that's already happened? It seems futile. And of course, the question is misdirected because there are a number of reasons. One of them is that history is part of that architecture of our identity. So if you want to know who you are, the only way to answer that is through an examination of your history and then history more generally. Without that, you don't have much of a developed identity at all. It's that important. Stemming from that, of course, is a risk that you can start to recreate your identity depending on which bits of history you emphasize. And you see this in some countries when they gain independence. All of a sudden, the people are fervent, whatever it is, the new national state, and they realign elements of history to fortify that sense of collective identity. So history absolutely feeds into identity. And the other thing, at a more practical level, it's simply the best textbook for dealing with the realities of life that we have. No other way, no other source will guide you through challenges that you face in terms of whatever it is in the areas that you work in, apart from history. So if you've got a country that's arming itself and about to carry out military maneuvers on the border of another country, what does that mean? Well, there's enough historical information accessible now that we can get a sense of what the possibilities might mean, how to diffuse that, all these sorts of things. Without that knowledge, we just keep tripping up over the same mistake over and over again. And that's one of the problems of not being aware of history. You have this enforced forgetfulness. And so you keep tripping up over something because you've forgotten that someone's been on that route already. This is the mistake they made. We can learn from it. Or this is the technique they used. Again, we can take advantage of it.
Do you think, though, it's... Well, we obviously learn from history. Says me, the layman, to you, it gives us a vocabulary that we can use today to understand where we are. And I'm a great proponent of the concept of tradition, the Latin, which means to hand on. We pass things on generation to generation.
I think we'd disagree on that one. I think
really,
I'm sensing that you're using this in the context of the Catholic tradition in particular, and the Catholic Church cites tradition as the basis of so much of its authority for what it does. In a way, that's a bogus claim, and it's bogus because the tradition was new at some point. So, take the tradition of purgatory or the tradition of limbo, where the Church itself oscillates between yes, this is true, no, it's not. The proponents say of limbo or purgatory will cite tradition, church tradition. But that's not an authority. That's just an accumulation of years for an idea. So if I propose to you that limbo applies to people up to the age of 19, which is absurd, really, is the original limbo concept in a way. You might think, well, that's a silly idea, Paul. But if that idea keeps circulating for the next 1200 years, all of a sudden it's part of tradition and it has an authority that doesn't come from anything other than repetition in time.
That makes sense, actually, and a good challenge. So the concept that you're arguing here is that something like tradition, if it's not grounded in, if you will, a reality, it's just an idea that's been passed on and time gives it a authority that it may not deserve.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with tradition in itself. So some families might have a tradition of gathering at a certain time, or there might be traditions around certain practices such as funerals, relationships, whatever. And there's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. But as an authority for how to act, I think you have to be a bit more discerning. And a lot of what happened during the Reformation was about challenging those traditions because they were found in some cases to be hollow.
Yeah, well, I gave a talk recently on that, actually, in terms of the notion of belief versus reality. Simply that we believe something simply because it's been our tradition doesn't actually make it true. You need objective reality. And I suppose, isn't that an element of what history or historians trying to do? Try to get in behind what's being discussed, observed, and go, what's the basis or the foundation?
They try to, but there are all sorts of pressures, obviously, on a historian, so that the field they work in might be too narrow, they might be influenced by the ideology of the day, or they might be fighting the ideology of the day, which in itself is an influence. So there's all these sorts of things that come to play, but there are established methods established over 200 or 300 years at least, of how to treat evidence, how to deal with different categories of evidence, how to prioritise them, how to see cause and effect, how not to see cause and effect. And all these techniques, when they're applied, help build a reasonably good picture of the past if they're handled correctly. It's not like the law where in a court case it's adversarial, where you've got one person arguing this point of view and selecting the evidence that helps their client, and the other person arguing the opposite, selecting a completely different set of evidence from the same pool. Historians try really to combine all evidence and let that speak for itself rather than make a case and then get the evidence to fit around it. Unfortunately, there are exceptions to that, not so much in history, but certainly in other disciplines, people have decided, I have a point of view and I will harness those points from the past that support my view.
My observation is that it is creeping into history now. Again, and it's a question as much as a statement to you, because I'm seeing a lot more people demanding their history and their interpretation and twisting things. In other words, they take a particular position on an issue, whatever it is, find the little bits and bits of bobs which support them, and off they go. And so they're twisting history to fit their ideology. And I better be clear, I don't think that I can sit with my interest in history and say, hey, I've got it perfectly right. I've got my own biases. But are we seeing more people, if you will, twisting history, that relativism which we've seen across so many disciplines, is it now coming into history, or is these methods that you talk about robust enough to keep that at a distance?
Well, I think you're right that no one can claim that the history they've written is absolutely true. And if they do make that claim, I think they're being, well, showing a degree of lack of awareness of their own abilities. Of course, we're influenced by all sorts of things, even in the most essential things, the moral judgments. We look at, you know, a mass killing. Is that bad or good? Well, you could make the case that you shouldn't answer that as a historian. It's not your job to make a moral judgment about it. It's your job to portray what happened and why. Let the reader decide. But inevitably, we have to exercise moral judgments because we're moral beings. And not to do so, you can end up being too detached and too clinical and not give any meaning to things. Moral actions have moral consequences. So if someone does commit a mass murder, you could say, well, this is how many people were killed, this is why they did it, and so on. But there's going to be moral reactions, since you have to immerse yourself in the world of the community that's affected and so on to get a sense of why people do what they do and why they react and so on. So yes, there will be biases, and we're bound by the time we live in, the issues we bring to our approach. But the method of dealing with evidence has to be adhered to. So, and again, the lawyer case might be an example. A lawyer will perhaps defend a rapist in court. Now, the lawyer will find the rapist's actions repugnant, but they will have a particular approach to dealing with evidence, which separates their own moral feelings from the profession they're involved in. And that detachment's crucial. Unfortunately, now in many disciplines, and it is creeping into history, there are some people who have a particular ideological tilt on things, and perhaps we all do, but they allow their work to be infused with that tilt, and they begin to develop patterns where they don't admit contrary evidence, or they dismiss it, or they undermine it, or whatever. And that's unfortunate. But I put it like this: it doesn't pass the sniff test, because when you read these works, even if you're an absolute supporter of that person's ideology, you can sniff that this is not serious history in the sense that it doesn't adhere to the rules of method. It's the sort of history that's really propaganda. Dressed up as history, has all the apparatus of it, the footnotes, the bibliography. It looks like it's well argued, but you can sniff that something's not quite right here. And I think that's a huge disservice to the discipline and to readers.
It won't surprise you that I agree. Look, I found it in political life, which is not as noble as that of a historian. But so many people, and maybe I was guilty of this too, you take a position, you take a moral position on something, and you just find the evidence to try and support your cause. You know, in the social media space, we're talking about narrowcasting. You only look, think, and read about that which agrees. So, I mean, how do you... It's probably a personal question. As a historian, you'll have a view. How is it that you've processed quite substantial contrary evidence? Has there been moments where you've had that? You've had a perception, you've done your research, and you come across something quite liminal, changing. I mean, how have you faced that? I mean, you're a professional, of course, but what is that moment like?
Well, I did a short booklet. It was about 130 pages looking at the state of te reo Māori at the moment, a bit about the history of how we got to where we are and what's the future for the language. And I wasn't prepared for the reaction of it. It was really hostile. In fact, even just a couple of weeks ago, someone emailed me expressing their outrage. This is 6 years ago it came out, I think. Because I pointed out the language is facing some really serious challenges, and a lot of the so-called solutions are ill-conceived and not working, and I based on a lot of international evidence. Now, one of the things I was accused of was being anti the language, which was silly because I said, look, in a way I'm te reo's best friend, because what a good friend will do is tell you the truth about your situation. They won't just say, oh look, you're wonderful, it's fine, and this, they'll be honest with you. And this was an honest, in a sense, interaction with the state of the language now and what's going wrong with the efforts to revive it. But before I published it, I actually sent it around to a number of other academics, two or three, whose views I like, and I said, gave them the instruction. I said, read through this, it's not a long book. Destroy it. I want you to take it apart. I want you to find errors with it. I want you to find alternative views. So I did this myself, but I sort of went through a process of destruction testing where a number of us tried to attack it from any different angle possible. And so when it was finally released, in a sense, it was as close to bulletproof as you can get. And yes, there was a lot of criticism, but the criticism never amounted to much. And I was disappointed too that some of the vocal public critics of it, I said to them, look, I'm happy to debate this with you anywhere, anytime you want. Just give me 48 hours notice. I can be there. I will do it. The one catch is I want it done in public so people can see for themselves. And not one person who criticized it was prepared to stand up to it. And I thought that was disappointing. If you're going to make a criticism of something, you should back it with evidence. They couldn't. And that revealed a sort of another aspect of a lot of issues now, which is emotion trumps evidence.
Oh, it's something which frustrates me endlessly. I'm a great believer in debate and discussion. I hold really strong views across a whole range of topics. But one of the things I enjoy the most is actually debating them and having them challenged. But these days, as you say, you get, well, my terms here, you get shouted down, cancelled, all of this stuff. It's like, how are we going to progress forward? And maybe that's an argument. Not that we need more, but an argument for history. Again, we can look in the past and see what happens. When going back to our earlier discussion, when actually belief or tradition or a set of values is prioritized over discussion and seeking, if you will, a foundation for truth.
Absolutely. And again, going back just before the Reformation, and remember, the Reformation was led by Catholics. This is something that people forget. They see it as a Protestant-Catholic issue. Absolutely not. I mean, Martin Luther, I think for the whole of his life, identified himself as a Catholic.
Yeah, as an Augustinian monk.
Yeah, but you see within the Catholic Church, people starting to question the theology of the time and the obvious errors in that theology. and that, you know, a lot of them paid for it with their lives. They were tortured and so on. And you've got to wonder what sort of organization has to punish people for alternative views. The simple way to destroy them is just to point out why their views are wrong. And look, if someone comes to me tomorrow and says, you know, Paul, we've disproved everything you've written. Here's the evidence. All I can do is say, yes, you're right. I'm sorry, I got it wrong. I made an honest attempt, but this new evidence shows the alternative. Fair enough. But you don't suppress people, because if you do, that indicates that you're scared of those ideas. And that's an indication of the potency of the idea in the first place. And the one thing history shows about ideas is that if they are worthwhile and valid and have substance, they don't go away. They can mutate, they can be expressed in different ways, but they just keep burrowing away and burrowing away until you confront them. And all you ever do by suppression is just delay the inevitable. It's not a solution. And unfortunately, people who do suppress various views at the moment don't appreciate that. Their fragility is such, they think if we put enough pressure on individuals not to say things, then our view of the world will triumph. And you've already lost at that point. You just don't realize it.
Oh, completely agree. In fact, my observation is that you get increasing coercion, if not violence, to hold those positions against the other ideas. And you're quite correct, says me to the historian, that in the Reformation, Counter-Reformation, pre-Enlightenment, we put people in stocks, burned them alive, all sorts of things to try and stop ideas. And in today's world, without drawing the analogy too far, you're put in the stocks of public opinion and derided online, or find that your speaking slots are cancelled, but the ideas keep going.
That's absolutely right. And I think that if you are certain about things, or certain as you can be, it creates an obligation to do something about it. I got cancelled from a talk I was due to give, an innocuous talk on heritage buildings or something, I think. And literally the day before...
On heritage buildings?
Yeah. And someone had in this committee of this group that was organising it decided that... it was too much of a risk, and so they cancelled me that day, the day before, and they said, look, we've decided we're going to have another speaker, and that's okay. But it doesn't really change anything. It just says, you know, we're going to try to, I don't know, whatever, stop you or cancel you, whatever. That doesn't change the ideas. They're out there. They're doing their work. And the best way, as I say, to contend with an idea you don't like is just to point out why you don't like it and deconstruct it. If you can't, maybe you might want to consider that your own ideas aren't quite right.
Well, I certainly found in my previous career in life, get lots of emails from people, didn't matter if it's on economic issues, ethical issues, whatever, people would write and tell me that I'm a, well, let's, what's the sort of words I can use on radio, but politely tell me I was an idiot, or impolitely. But I'd often write back and say, look, I'd really like to understand why you think I'm wrong. I could well be wrong, but basically they'd never reply. If they did, it was more abuse. I shouldn't laugh. It was terrible at one level. So what do you make then of this right side of history? It's one of my little bugbears, I better declare that, but people who run around saying you've got to be on the right side of history. To me, it's an arrogance because we don't know how history is going to judge us. But your perspective as a historian?
Oh, it doesn't even make sense. I think if anyone says you've got to be on the right side of history, it's an appeal to nothing. Firstly, there aren't sides of history. It's far more nuanced than that. It's very intricately marbled. It's not this monochrome that you're either there or here. It's much more complex. Secondly, it implies there's a moral absolute that prevails, that you've got to be in the right group to be judged this way in the future. Thirdly, there's a presumption that we know how people in the future will judge us, and we don't, because we're pretty harsh on people in the past. We're very good at looking at the 19th century and saying, well, how could they act like that? How could they have those values? But one thing is absolutely certain is that 150 years from now, people will be looking at us with exactly the same view. How on earth could people in 2024 hold the values that they do? It's absurd. It's embarrassing. And so the presumption that there's a right side of history flies against the fact that history and the moral attitudes of societies keep evolving anyway. So there is no absolute right side. The idea that it's binary, right and wrong, doesn't exist. It's also denial of diversity, that if you look at, you know, we live in Auckland, it's an incredibly diverse city, and it's so much the richer for that. The idea that you have to place people in the right or wrong category is just arrogance, and it's ignorance, and it doesn't achieve anything. What's the point? The only thing I think it's used for is so people can advance their view to say, this is another reason why you have to believe what I believe in, because if you don't, you'll be judged later on as being wrong. Well, that's an appalling way to make a case. You make a case because you got the evidence, not because some future society is going to see you as being in the wrong place at the wrong time. You'll be in the ground by that point. So it's a silly argument.
Oh, it frustrates me no ends. As I say, I'm not a fatalist, but it's like, well, actually, as you say, I'll be dead, so who particularly cares what they think of me? But it's just a rhetorical flourish, it seems, which shuts things down. But what I don't understand, and maybe you've got an insight, is how do those who use the statement so blind to that contradiction we just briefly touched on, which is they sit in judgment of history, the Victorian era, or whenever, and question all the beliefs. They don't sit historically in the time and go, well, why did they think that way? They judge them on today's values, yet don't seem to have the wherewithal to go, the next generation, the generation after, are going to apply the same test to us. Do they really think, and I'm probably misquoting here, but Fukuyama, that history's ended with us. Right now, we're perfect. We know everything. It's what's driving that contradiction? How can they not see it?
I think you've hit the nail on the head with Fukuyama. I mean, it was a preposterous assertion in the late 80s, but he thought when the communist states in Eastern Europe were collapsing, he thought, well, there's going to be social democracy spread throughout the world. It's the end of history. And it was a bit more fine-tuned than that, but that was the essence of his argument. And of course, it's completely wrong. But there is this, what you could call an apex thinking, which is where we are now is the best of all possible moral worlds. And we've reached the point where we've dispensed with religious morality, we've dispensed with traditional morality. We can look back at previous societies, and the only thing we can do is judge them harshly because they haven't reached our stage of enlightenment. The Whig historians in the 19th century in Britain applied this to British history. They said that British history was the apex of all history, and it's a history of relentless progress. Then you hit World War I with the mass deaths on the fronts. And of course, then you get to the Second World War with the Holocaust, and you realize, well, we haven't got a lot to be proud about or wave our flags about, because this moral greatness comes with moral degradation of a sort that's almost unimaginable. But it's an arrogance to think that where we are now is the peak of moral rectitude. And there are very good reasons to argue against that, for all sorts of reasons. Firstly, that it's a form of moral relativism. Secondly, there's no greater moral authority for a lot of Western societies than the harm principle. So you can do whatever you want, provided it doesn't harm anyone else. And that seems to be the governing principle. And so previous societies had all these repressive moral rules, but now we're liberated from that. You can do whatever you want, be whoever you want, act however you want, provided you don't cause harm to others. And that seems to have settled as the way modern societies see themselves. So it is an end of history point in a way. The problem with the harm principles, there's a lot of problems. One of them is, what's wrong with harm? This is what Nietzsche pointed out. What's if I want to cause harm to someone because it brings me satisfaction, what's morally wrong with that? Your only appeal is to the harm principle itself, so it's not an authority. It's a statement. I mean, you can go back to John Stuart Mill and say, well, Mill's my authority for not causing harm to others. But I could appeal to Nietzsche and say, well, what's wrong with causing harm? I want to. And that's a conundrum. Then there's all sorts of other problems associated with it as well, because, and not to put too fine a point on it, but using that harm principle, is it okay? I mean, bestiality is the example that's sometimes used, that you could justify bestiality on the basis that doesn't cause harm to anyone else, perhaps to the animal, but then that's countered by the fact that we kill and eat animals. So the harm principle isn't a good basis for a lot of areas of how we act. But more importantly, it doesn't have a greater moral authority than itself. So it can't by itself, necessarily, it can't prohibit harm. It's just an appeal to not do harm. But so what? If my moral code says I want to inflict harm on people, the harm principle doesn't prevent that. And so the idea that this is the best we've ever been, I think, is an illusion. And we're already seeing things fraying at the edges, and it may get much worse.
I completely agree. The harm principle does my head in. Not that I want to inflict harm, let's be really clear to listeners, but as you say, as a principle, it doesn't have much depth. And you've just illustrated how putting even the slightest pressure on it, it begins to buckle. But I suppose the wider question is, does every, if you will, generation or every, I don't know, civilization think it's at the apex? Did the British Empire think it had it all set? Did the Romans, the Carthaginians, if we want to go back thousands of years, does each, I'll just say epoch, that's too big. Is this just a constant repeat? Is this, again, why we need to study history, to realise that every generation thinks it's got it together, and yet we should see we're always on a path of learning?
There was a historian who, when he was 8 years old, watching Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, he later reflected on that, and he said that it felt like the British Empire would never come to an end. And there's that old saying that the sun never sets on the British Empire. And the late 19th century was really the high point of popular enthusiasm in Britain for its empire. It was almost a cult, and it had all its paraphernalia. It was people turned a blind eye to the destruction it had caused, and they relished all the advantages it had supposedly brought. One of the interesting things about apex points in civilizations or cultures is that they're at the very end of the life cycle of that. So if you look at the British Empire, it starts in a reasonably serious way in the 1500s, and you've got 350 years, say, of ascent. But it's only at the tail end, when the wheels are falling off, but people aren't quite aware of it yet, that they're still relishing the past accomplishments. And they've built up a mythology about how wonderful it is, and they've built up a mythology about themselves. You know, we belong to the great empire. Gladstone said, if you're a Briton who doesn't have an imperial spirit in you, you're the equivalent of a Briton who's blind or lame, that you're an anomaly. He said it's almost innate in Britons that you have this imperial spirit, because Britons are set apart as a race. It's preposterous to read that now, but this was the view in the second half of the 19th century. But it's the view that comes at the very end of that cycle of, in this case, say, empires or particular culture. And we just don't notice it. The point at which we're rejoicing most in the way we are now is often the most dangerous point, because we're too busy parting, as it were, not realizing that everything that we hold to be dear is already falling apart.
That's actually quite profound, returning to a word I used earlier. That's given me a lot to think about on top of everything else, actually. Yeah, that moment of change when actually, or potentially decline, actually, is the moment you begin to see where your values, morals, ethics, and various systems underpinning society are actually being called into deep question. Well, that's really cool, Paul. You've almost stumped me thinking about that one. So really fascinating point, Paul, around apex as people perceive history, perhaps at that turning point, or rather they begin to perceive what they think is the great elements of themselves or society as it's actually turning. But I wonder, in the wider sense, and I'm thinking of particularly our current generation that are very focused on the now, as we say, the right side of history, they think they've got it right. In some ways, they don't see a value of history or objective history. It's just something for them to interpret. Does that, you think, lead to a certain loneliness? They're not connected to the past. They don't see the past as having value beyond what suits them. Do you think there's some relationship here, psychologically or otherwise? I know you're a historian, but do you think part of the modern loneliness, anxiety, is linked to a lack of knowledge or understanding of history?
Well, look, you go to a restaurant, and one of the things you may see when the meal is served, traditionally people would eat that meal. Now, some people pull out their phones and take a photograph of it before they eat it. Why? We know why. Because they're going to put it on social media to say, this is the wonderful meal, it's so well presented, and so on. But here's an interesting thing about that process is I don't think there are many people who will take that photo of their meal, then wait 7 or 8 months and then post it. They have to post it pretty much that day. Why is that? Because there's a sense of immediacy about living in the eternal present. What matters to me is what's happening right now. No one's interested in a meal you had 7 months ago, but people might be interested in a meal you're having right now. So there's this fixation with the eternal present, that only what's happening now. And then we start to live our lives, using the photo analogy, and it's a series of snapshots of right now. It's just what I'm doing now that matters, or what I'm about to do. That's all that matters. People even frame in their minds, I'm going out with the kids. Actually, we could get a good photo for social media. Yeah, it's about that sort of connection. So there's a validation in living in the eternal present, and that's quite dangerous. It's rather like, I think it's Chesterton, but probably others have said similar things, that if you stop believing in God, it's not that you believe in nothing anymore, you believe in everything. And you become, in a sense, have your faith directed across every possible thing, because there's a belief urge that people have, and if it's not directed at some point, it might be misdirected at others. But people, I think, have got caught up in this belief that what's happening now is what matters the most. What that does, it not only amputates you from history, which means all those lessons and all that sense of identity become impoverished, but it also anticipates you from projecting into the future. So perhaps you don't see the future in terms of something bigger than the next opportunity, the next hit, the next experience. The analogy with drug addicts, the analogy with people who watch a lot of TikTok is very similar. That sort of perhaps a dopamine effect or something that you have by the next hit, by the next hit. And living that way is not a fulfilling way to live your life. There's not that much substance in it.
Well, it's no surprise you've put it much more articulately than me, but I do worry at times of, yes, as you say, those people so in the present, they worry for the future, but no deep appreciation or learnings from the past. And speaking of the past, you put up on LinkedIn the other day, and it's a mouthful, temporal, moral, demutation? Good Lord, I think of myself as a lover. Yes. Demutation. A lover of the English language. I can't even say that word. I just thought it was a fascinating concept, and I think a great way to begin wrapping this discussion up. So what is temporal moral demutation?
Well, it's basically the idea that the further back something exists in our past, or the past generally, the less we apply a moral lens to it. The war in between Russia and Ukraine at the moment, or the actions taking place with Israel dealing with Gaza and so on, these provoke quite strong moral reactions. We don't have the same moral reaction to the Napoleonic Wars or to wars that were fought thousands of years ago. Why is that? Well, you might answer, well, because it's, you know, beyond our lifetime and so on. But there seems to be a pattern that the further away we are from an event, the less we tend to see it in moral terms, the more we see it in apparently neutral or objective terms. So no one really looks at the Napoleonic Wars now and says, well, oh, I'm furious with how that turned out, and there's outrage over it. It's laughable that we might react that way. But here's the thing. People are going to look at events in Israel and Gaza now. They're going to look at events in Russia and Ukraine 200 years in the future, and similarly have very little moral engagement with it. And this is the crucial point, that our moral sort of tension eases the further back something is. And it happens to us individually. You know, if you're out, say, with your wife in the country one evening, it's raining, you're going to a party or something, you're all dressed up, you get a flat tire. You hop out of the car and change it, and you know, you get soaked and muddy and it's cold, and you bruise yourself perhaps in your knuckles or something, whatever. You hop back in the car and you're not in the greatest of moods. You're actually quite angry at this. And your wife turns to you and she says, you know, Simon, you know, one day we'll look back at this and laugh. And that's not a good thing to say to you at that moment, because you're quite upset still. But she's absolutely right. And a couple of years later, she'll recall that and you'll both laugh. Now, the event hasn't changed. The feelings you had at that event haven't changed. But the way you look back on it has. And we ease the tension over time. And so that idea of temporal moral diminution is one that the further back something is, the less we invest moral energy into it. And so the event doesn't change, but our perception of it does over time. It applies to us personally and applies to history.
Yeah, I was really struck by it as I read what you had written, and I wondered as much to myself as anyone, when I react, if you will, morally, emotionally to events today, to somewhat think about tempering them, understanding that actually that moral perspective will change over time. In other words, does appreciating history help me moderate how I act today? I just thought it was a fascinating concept. Hey, and last challenge, you mentioned Israel-Gaza. I'm not dragging you into that topic, but it reminded me of Jonathan Sacks, that I think remarkable chief rabbi, who spoke about the difference between history and memory. Now, he was particularly talking about the story of the Jewish people, and he recounts talking to Isaiah Berlin, who talked about, in this case, the Jewish people having a sense of history, the things that had happened to them. But Jonathan Sacks says, no, actually, it's about memory. It's us recounting the stories of what happened to him, to them. Do you see a difference between history and memory, or is it just semantics?
No, they definitely overlap. But there is an important difference, I think, in the sense that Jonathan Sacks was addressing it, that memory is repeated down generations. There's a transmission mechanism in some cultures that they take certain memories or certain aspects of their past and they transmit them as being absolutely central. They're axiomatic to who you are. And one of the arguments for that is that that contributes to the strength of the group through enhancing or fortifying their identity. So what makes you who you are? Well, these are the memories you need to know. And you can see this in cultures around the world. People in the Balkans, for example, discussions about events that took place in 1389 in southern Serbia still form the basis. They're at the epicenter of what's happening to that country today. And you might think, why on earth is that? Because the traditions about that have been passed down to say, this is the central identity marker of who we are. And those traditions typically involve things like sacrifice, ill treatment at the hands of others, pervading injustice, but the triumph of the group despite that. And it's a real sort of galvanizing effect when you have that sort of memory being transmitted through generations. And I think that's one of the reasons for it. It's not conventional formal history because it doesn't treat evidence in certain ways, it doesn't embrace alternative views. And precisely because of that, when you get two cultures that have similar memory transmission mechanisms next to each other, and those are fundamentally opposed, the resolution is not in history. The resolution isn't in just evidence. It's almost like you're asking the cultures to deconstruct in order to resolve, and that's not going to happen because the essence of identity and culture is held in those perceptions based on memory.
That's another profound, I'm sorry, that's the word of the day for me, profound, another profound insight. It's one of the reasons I love interviewing people. It's fascinating in itself, but there's always elements, Paul, I take away that challenge me, and I've got at least three, if not four, that you've dropped clangers for me, so I'm going to be spending hours pondering this. So can I say a big thank you for joining us, talking and sharing your views and perspectives on history, on memory, and how we draw that together to help us in society today. And of course, for talking about your new book. So everyone, can I encourage you to, look up Paul's work, look up his latest book on Arns Westra, as you say, all good bookstores. And Paul, thank you so much for making, all this time to come and chat with us.
Thank you very much, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.